Tucker, Arkansas. A small room off a hallway that smelled of bleach and hot dust. A wooden table. A box with a crank. The men who worked here called it a telephone. The inmates did not. The device lived on the edge of routine. It came out when the story did not match the logbook, or when a field tally ran short, or when someone was marked as trouble. The guard on the door kept his voice level. The man at the crank kept his eyes down. There was no shouting. No rush. Only a set of gestures that looked like any other job at a farm prison. In that quiet, the line between punishment and pain blurred. Later, people would argue about who ordered it, who built it, and when it finally stopped. In this room, in that hour, the only question was whether the man standing there would talk. Chapter 1. The phone rings in Tucker. The Tucker unit sat low on the landscape, flat fields and straight fences running to the horizon. The buildings were plain. The paint was tired. The routine was the point. Men woke before daylight. They lined up. They went to work. Supervisors watched the lines and counted hands by habit. It felt like a farm because it was a farm, but it was also a prison. Control was the crop that mattered. The small room off the corridor looked like storage at first glance. A table, two chairs, a cabinet with a padlock, a mop bucket in the corner. The light hung from the ceiling and hummed. The air held the sharp smell of bleach and the dull weight of heat. When the door shut, the hall noise dropped away. The door had a simple view window. A guard stood there with his arms folded and his eyes steady. He did not speak much. He did not need to. On the table sat a box with a handle. It looked like a field telephone. The handle turned a small generator inside. Wires ran to two leads. The surface showed scuffs and fingerprints from many hands. The men who used it called the handle the crank. They made short circles with it. They had names for the strength of the turn. They kept those names to themselves. Inmate accounts later used plain words. Shock. Hurt. Stop. The device had a job in this place. It was not on a posted list. It did not appear on a form. It came out when the story and the ledger did not match. It came out when a line boss said a worker lagged on purpose. It came out when a man was marked as a thief, or a fighter, or a talker. It came out when someone wanted a quick confession that could be written down in neat script and filed on a shelf. The process fit the rhythm of the farm. Quick, efficient, and quiet. Inmates gave the device a name that stuck. They called it the Tucker telephone. The name traveled through the barracks on low voices at night. New men heard it in their first week. Old men avoided the word. The name told a story in three syllables. Place. Object. Threat. It did not need more. How the device worked, in simple terms, was not a mystery. A hand turned the crank. The crank spun a small dynamo. The dynamo sent current through wires to contact points. The contact points touched skin. The body felt the current as pain. If the hand moved faster, the current rose. If the hand slowed, the current fell. Men who told their stories later used the same motion in the air when they spoke. A wrist turned in a small circle. Their eyes went to the table, as if it was still in front of them. What parts of this account were proven, and what parts were alleged must be clear. It is proven that the Tucker unit existed as a prison farm, and that control over inmates included corporal and coercive methods in the mid-20th century. It is proven that men returned from the small room shaken, compliant, and sometimes injured. It is alleged by multiple former inmates and some former staff that a hand-cranked telephone generator was used as an instrument to force compliance and extract confessions. It is alleged that approval for this practice ran upward through ranks, and that some supervisors and medical staff knew of it or took part. The record from that era did not preserve a clear chain of orders. The silence of routine did that work. To the men who guarded that door, the work seemed straightforward. They were told to hold a line. They were told to keep the farm running and the numbers in order. They watched for fights. They watched for escape. They watched for the signs of a lie. When a story did not settle, the small room could settle it. The men at the crank said little. They did not joke. They did not boast in public. The quiet felt like policy. The men who faced the table tried to read the rules. Some tried to talk fast and clear. Some stared at the floor and tried to hold their breath. Some asked for the captain or the major. Rank carried weight in halls like these. The answer often remained the same. The door clicked. The guard stood still. The man with the crank looked at the wires and not at the face in front of him. The device did not look like a noose or a club. It did not leave marks as clear as a strap. It did not fill a yard with sound. That was part of its power. Men walked back to the barracks with their feet under them and their heads low. They found their bunks and lay there and looked at the ceiling. They kept their voices down when others asked what happened. They said it was the phone. That was all. The room had done its work. Accounts placed the use of the device into the late 1960s and into the early 1970s. Dates floated in statements and letters from that period. The years marked a time when the prison farm model met rising pressure from reformers, reporters, and courts. In Tucker, routine still pressed forward. Rows were hoed. Pigs were fed. Cotton weighed and moved. The small room stayed quiet. The crank kept turning until the day someone told it to stop, and that day did not come all at once. Allegations touched many ranks. Inmates named floor officers who led them down the hall. They named sergeants who signed them out of work lines. They named a nurse who fixed a lead with a rag before the crank turned. In some accounts, a doctor was present. In some accounts, a high official used the crank himself. Those last claims always drew the sharpest pushback. No public record settled the claim to certainty in that hour. The line between rumor and memory is thin when fear lives in the middle of it. Still, the names keep appearing in different hands, in different years, in different rooms. The room's power came not only from pain. It came from the sense that the device and the people around it were part of the normal order. The mop still leaned in the corner. The light still hummed. The pencil still moved across the charge book. That everyday feel trained men to accept what they knew was wrong. It told them that the farm had rules that lived behind the posted rules. Those hidden rules said that order mattered more than truth. They said that speed mattered more than fairness. They said that a body could be made to agree. A man who refused to talk could hold out for a time. He could count the turns of the crank. He could dig his fingernails into his palm. He could try to hold his breath and ride the wave. He could tell himself to think of another place. Most men did not last long. The body overruled the mind. The sentence shaped the choice. The farm had a way of narrowing every path until only one door remained. The Tucker telephone did not come with a manual. Skills passed from hand to hand. A senior man showed a junior man how to hold the leads, where to place them, how fast to turn, when to stop, when to start again. The senior man explained how to write the report after. Keep it short. Keep it clean. No detail that could be read aloud later and draw heat. The lesson fit the system that raised it. It prized results. It feared sunlight. In a place like Tucker, language carried weight. The word telephone softened the truth. It made a weapon sound like a tool. It put distance between the act and the pain. Men who would never call themselves torturers could call themselves operators. Men who would never call a room a chamber could call it an office. Words stacked up until they hid the shape of what they covered. Years later, when people tried to name what happened, the old words still got in the way. Inside the small room, power sat on the table in the form of a crank and a wire. Power stood at the door with a key on a ring. Power wrote the line that said a man had confessed. Power moved in quiet and kept its pace. The farm ran on that pace. The men learned how to match it or break against it. What remains from that era is a pattern, a device with a name. A set of stories that line up more often than they split. A building plan that shows where a room could be. Ledger entries that spike after certain dates. Medical notes that talk around bruises and burns. None of it sings on its own. Together, it forms a low note that is hard to ignore. The question that ends this chapter is the one that walked down that hallway day after day. Who built the device? Who first set it on the table? Who said yes when it rolled from one year into the next? The farm taught people to look down and move forward. The truth asks them to look up and look back. This is the start of that work. The small room is empty now in this telling. The light still hums. The table shows scars. The mop leans in the corner. The device is gone. The name remains. The Tucker telephone stands as a phrase that people still say when they talk about abuse of power and the long shadow of control. What happens next depends on records, testimony, and the pressure of a world that finally looked in. That is the road the story will take from here. Chapter 2, Farm Prisons. At Tucker, the day began before sunrise. A whistle cut the dark. Men stepped out of the barracks and formed ranks without talk. Each man carried a hoe or a short-handled tool. A trusty stood near the door with a rifle set across his arms. he counted as the line moved. The goal was simple: get hands to the field and bring them back the same number. Tucker State Farm opened in 1916 on flat land that gave long views in every direction. The state built it as a working farm, not as a stone fortress. Fences and fields did the work of walls. The rows stretched out in straight lines, and the work squads moved down those lines from light to dark. The idea was old. The farm would feed the prison and sell the surplus. Inmates would supply the labor. Work set the rhythm of the place. In planting and harvest, days ran long. 10 to 15 hours in the field was common when the weather held. Men carried water cans down the rows and shared a dipper. Breaks were short. A line boss looked at the sky and watched the speed of the hoe blades. When a cloud crossed the sun, no one slowed. The job list sat in a book, and the book did not care about heat or rain. Food matched the budget. Breakfast was simple and heavy. Bread, a ladle of grits, sometimes eggs. Lunch rode in buckets to the rows. Beans. Rice. A bit of meat when the herd allowed it. Supper came after count. Inmates ate fast because lights out came early and morning came early. The calories kept men on their feet, but not much more. The men who did the hardest jobs stayed hungry, even after they cleaned their trays. Medical care was thin. A sick call list formed at dawn. A nurse checked temperatures and gave out aspirin. A man with a cut got a bandage. A man with a fever got a cot and water. The farm could not run if too many men stayed back, so most went to the field unless they could not stand. When someone went down in the rows, others lifted him to shade and waited for a cart. The cart was a flatbed pulled by a small tractor. The driver did not rush. The work line bent around the spot and kept moving. The farm relied on the trusty system. A trustee was an inmate with authority over other inmates. Trustees held keys. Trustees carried rifles. Trustees gave orders in the barracks and in the field. The state paid few free world guards. The budget was tight. Trustees filled the gap. They were chosen for their willingness to enforce rules and keep the pace. They got extra food, better bunks, and small privileges. They also got the blame when things went wrong. Trustees stood at the ends of the rows. They walked the lines with a slow, steady step. They watched hands and backs. They watched for talk in the ranks. They watched for eyes that looked to the fence. The rifle was not a stage prop. The rule on the ground was known: keep the line moving, keep the numbers right, keep order with the tools you have. The trustee system mixed power with survival. A man who took a rifle gained safety from the worst jobs. He gained a little meat on his plate. He gained time out of the hoe squads. He also took on the risk that other men would hate him, and the risk that the office would drop him the first time a count came up wrong. The job made enemies. It also made a system that did not need many paid guards to function. Inside the barracks, trustees set lights out and woke men before the whistle. They called names for detail work: kitchen, laundry, hog barn. They kept a list for punishments that did not require a trip to an office. A man who mouthed off could find himself on a worse field the next day. A man who failed his quota could find himself posted to a ditch with a shovel for a week. The message was simple. The farm had many ways to make the day harder. Records lived in ledgers. The farm tracked bales, hog weights, egg counts, and churned butter. It tracked line assignments and medical slips. It tracked escapes and recoveries. The books did not record the small pressures that kept the line straight. Those lived in habit. A look from a trustee could move a man to pick up his pace. The click of a bolt behind a rifle could do the same without a word. The work covered many trades. Men hoed cotton and chopped weeds. They slopped hogs and scraped pens. They picked okra and cut hay. They repaired fences and greased tractors. They cleaned barns and hauled feed. The farm taught skills, but the aim was not training. The aim was output. If a man learned to mend a chain or tune a carburetor, that was good for the farm. It might be good for the man later. It was not the reason he learned. Discipline matched the work pace. The posted rules were simple. No fighting. No stealing. No talk back to officers or trustees. No leaving a line. The unposted rules were clearer. Keep the row straight. Keep your head down. Do not make a scene. The men who broke posted rules saw the inside of an office. The men who broke unposted rules felt the weight of extra duty or lost a privilege. The farm did not need a formal hearing for most things. It needed the day to end with the same count it began with, and the work done. The distance from town helped shape the culture. Few outside visitors came. Church groups came on Sundays and left after an hour. Vendors came to deliver feed and pick up meat. Reporters came only when the state invited them. That meant most disputes stayed inside the fence. A man who wanted to complain had few places to take his words. He could speak to a free guard if one stood nearby. He could write a letter and hope it passed the mailroom. He could try to tell a chaplain. None of these routes moved fast. The field moved faster. The trusty system rested on a simple idea. Inmates could control other inmates at a lower cost and with more reach than a small staff could manage. The idea saved money. It also blurred lines. When the man who wakes you and counts you is also the man who orders you to swing faster, power sits close to your face all day. That kind of closeness breeds fear and makes quiet rules feel permanent. Tucker had seasons of pride. The farm produced good crops in years with rain. Hogs went to market at strong weights. The dairy turned out steady milk. State officials pointed to those numbers and said the system worked. The numbers held a truth. The farm did produce. The numbers did not say what it cost in human terms to reach those totals day after day. Young men learned the system from older men. A new arrival watched how to hold the hoe and keep a pace that would not draw a word. He learned where to stand in the chow line to avoid a shove. He learned to step aside when a trustee crossed the barracks with a key ring. He learned to keep his eyes on the ground when an argument started. These lessons passed from bunk to bunk with few words. The layout of the place supported control. Long sight lines. Clear gates. A central office that saw the movement of squads as they left for the fields. A siren that could call men back. A set of kennels for tracking dogs sat near the tree line. The dogs were a fact of life. The handler walked them past the barracks at times. The message was quiet and clear. If you ran, we would find you. The medical room held a scale and a cabinet with supplies. A doctor came on scheduled days. A nurse kept the place running the rest of the time. Men with chronic pain learned to work through it. Men with broken teeth learned to chew on the other side. Men with old injuries waited for relief that did not come. The thin margin between fit and unfit pushed many to the field who would have stayed in bed in another world. Because Tucker was a farm, weather ruled. Too much rain filled the ditches and slowed tractors. Too little rain baked the ground and turned rows to dust. Heat made tempers short. Cold made hands stiff and careless. The work did not stop. It adjusted. Men pulled weeds by hand when tractors bogged down. Men burned weeds when blades could not cut. The farm asked for cleverness and endurance and paid in smaller rations and sleep. The chain of command looked clear on paper and messy in practice. A warden set policy from the office. Captains and lieutenants enforced it. Sergeants ran shifts. Trustees handled the details. On the ground, the trustee standing near you had more effect on your day than a title on a door. He could move you from a cotton row to a ditch without a form. He could put your name on a list. He could keep you off a detail that had shade. Some men tried to keep their records clean and ride out their time. They learned to make their row neat. They shook the dipper for the next man when they drank. They held their words tight and avoided the hot corners of the barracks. Others pushed back. They spoke up when a count looked wrong. They asked for the office when a trustee pushed them too far. The second group paid in extra duty and lost sleep. The first group paid in the small debts that come with silence. The farm kept a simple story for itself. Work builds character. Work keeps order. Work pays for the cost of keeping men in custody. That story ran into facts that did not fit. Some men came in with injuries that work did not heal. Some came in with minds that work did not steady. Some were boys when they arrived and men when they left with calloused hands and bad backs. The ledger had no column for that line. By the 1950s and 1960s, the model at Tucker looked settled. Large fields. Long lines of men. A small number of free officers. A larger number of trustees with keys and rifles. Thin medical care. Cheap meals. Strong output in good years. The parts fit together like a machine. When one part slipped, the pressure to keep the machine moving pressed down in other places. All of this made the farm efficient and brittle at the same time. The system could handle routine. It failed when the routine broke. A fight in the rows could pull a trustee off count. A heat wave could put three men on the ground in an hour. A rumor could ripple through a barracks and make sleep light for a week. The machine did not stop. It ground on. People found ways to make it work again, even if those ways cut corners or crossed lines. What matters for this story is how the structure shaped choices. A long day. A thin staff. a chain of trust that reached down into the barracks, a ledger that measured output by pounds and bales, a medical room that patched but did not cure. These conditions left few tools for patient investigation when a story did not add up. They rewarded speed. They rewarded fear. They kept most disputes inside the fence. That is why the question for the next chapter lands where it does. Which parts of this setup made routine abuse easier to hide and harder to stop? A system built on speed and trust inside the ranks can carry the seeds of harm. In a place where lines must move and books must balance, quiet methods rise. The shape of the farm made room for them. The next step is to look at who filled that room and how. Chapter 3, Inventors and Enforcers. The hospital wing at Tucker was spare. White walls, a steel cart with gauze and a brown bottle of disinfectant. A clock that ticked a little loud in the quiet. Men came here with cuts and fevers and broken teeth. They also came here when someone wanted answers that did not come in the barracks or the field. Staff kept a towel folded on a lower shelf. Under the towel sat a wooden box with a crank. The shape of the box told its story. It was a hand generator from a field or wall telephone. The kind that makes its own current when a wrist turns the handle. Wires ran from the case to two leads. The circuit was simple. Current leaves the box, crosses a body, and returns. Men who knew tools could picture it without seeing it. The rest learned the lesson in a single minute. The device had a name that men spoke in low voices. Tucker telephone. The words were plain and close to a joke, which made them worse. In prison slang, the worst version of its use was a long-distance call. That was a run of shocks without enough time to breathe in between. The slang traveled because the act traveled across years. It did not depend on one person or one day. It lived in routine. What can be called proven and what must be called alleged needs a clean line. It is proven that a hand-cranked telephone generator can deliver a painful shock when wired to a person. It is proven that former inmates from Tucker gave sworn and published accounts of such a device in the 1960s and into the 1970s. It is proven that the device's name appears in reports, in national magazines, and in later histories of the Arkansas farms. It is also proven that officials and trustees used the hospital as a site for discipline that went beyond dressing wounds. Those facts stand on written records, photographs of the device, and accounts that match in details over time. Encyclopedia of Arkansas. Plus one. Authorship is less clear. Some accounts point to a prison doctor who adapted a crank phone with extra batteries. Others point to a superintendent who wanted results and did not ask many questions about the method. A few say a former trustee who knew radios and phones built a box that others then copied. These claims run side by side in the record. The details match on the device. The names do not. The safest language is this. The Tucker telephone came from inside the prison and was kept in reach of those who worked there. The exact hand that assembled the first one is disputed. Encyclopedia of Arkansas. There are names that return when people tell the story. Men who ran places like Tucker had wide power. They set the tone and they set the pace. Inmates and some staff later said the superintendent's displeasure could be expressed with a turn of the crank. National reporters wrote that line when Arkansas first drew attention for its prisons. Those pieces do not always print a name, yet the meaning is not hidden. If top office holders did not order the crank turned, they allowed a climate where others felt free to do it. The hospital and the office sat in the same yard. The distance between them was a walk of 1 minute. Time. Medical staff appear in the story as well. A nurse who held a towel on a contact point. A doctor who checked a pulse and said to continue. These scenes live in sworn statements and in books that gathered testimony soon after the events. They show a profession pulled into control work in a place that prized speed over care. The doctor's oath bent under the weight of order and habit. This is the part that makes later readers stop and set the book down. Pain described by a patient is one thing. Pain structured by a clinic is another. Encyclopedia of Arkansas. By 1966, the quiet inside the farms had started to crack. The state police looked into Tucker. The findings did not print the next day on a front page, but the probe itself meant outside eyes were on the fields and the barracks and the hospital. People in uniform asked questions that did not stop at the first answer. That pressure did not end the practice. It did shift fear around. Guards and trustees watched one another as well as the lines. Inmates timed their words in the clinic and the hall. The pace of the farm continued. The crank did not vanish. DH site. In a room like this, the roles were plain. A man stood by the door with a key. A man managed the cart and looked like a nurse. A man worked the handle of the box. The man on the table held still because straps held him still. The hospital gave the scene a frame that felt official. There were towels. There was a tray. There was a sink. The presence of a sink does not wash and act clean. It only marks the room where it took place. If you look at the scene as a system, you find three forces at work. The first is a device that anyone can understand and most can operate. The second is a hierarchy that assigns small pieces of duty and lets big decisions hide in the gaps between them. The third is a culture that prefers quick answers over slow care. Those three forces together make a method like this easy to start and hard to stop. The men who later spoke about the device agreed on the look and the feel more than the names. They agreed on the slang. They agreed on the quiet tone that made it worse. They agreed on the room. When their stories diverged, it was usually on who stood where and which officer signed which line on a log. Memory is like that when pain is near. Yet the overlaps across different tellers and different years are hard to ignore. The hospital, the crank, the leads, the towel. There is a claim that the device sat in the hospital because that is where a shock could be described as medical. A man who fainted could be said to have low sugar. A man who could not stand could be told to drink water. Paperwork could list a checkup. If that sounds too neat for a place as rough as Tucker, remember that the rough places keep their own order. The cart rolled where people knew to look away. When the state police took interest in the farms, they did not begin with a box on a cart. They began with fights and missing property and men who did not come back from the fields. Talk about a crank phone that hurt people came later. It came in interviews and in the words of men who hesitated before they spoke. Investigators write such hesitation in their notes. They mark a pause and the look on a face. That is part of the record that rarely reaches a courtroom, yet shapes every page that does. The Tucker telephone did not replace the strap. It sat beside it in the choices available to those who wanted control. A strap leaves marks that witnesses can count. A shock leaves fewer that last. This difference mattered in a place where the goal was to get a sentence on paper and a line back to the field by noon. Fewer marks meant fewer questions from people who came on Sundays and fewer burdens for the small medical room on Mondays. It also meant a man could be harmed again without as much risk to those who did it. Who first brought the device through the hospital door is still an open question. So is the list of people who knew and said nothing. The box did not walk in by itself. The batteries did not wire themselves. The slang did not invent itself. People made these things and then passed them on. That is the human part that turns a tool into a practice and then into a culture. A reader might ask how a simple device and a few men could shape the life of a large place. The answer lies in the way a farm works. A farm is a chain of small decisions, repeated 1,000 times. Where the line starts. When the water can goes out. Who swings the hoe at which pace. Add a box and a handle to that chain, and it becomes part of the set. Once it is part of the set, it can be pulled out whenever speed or certainty seems worth the cost. There is a single line that connects this chapter to the first one. The small room and the name. The rest is new. A hospital cart. A towel. A box with a crank. A set of hands that learned emotion and taught it to others. The next turn in the story belongs to people who put cameras on tripods and notebooks on their knees. They asked for names, not slang. They asked for dates, not rumors. They asked for someone to stand under a light and answer questions in full. Chapter 4, The Exposé. The day broke cold over the river flats. Trucks rolled in with film crews and notebooks. A line of cameras faced a low rise near the levee. Men in coats stood close to keep the wind off their hands. The prison farm worked around them, as if it were any other morning. A superintendent in a plain jacket pointed to the ground and spoke in a quiet voice. A year earlier, the new governor had opened a door the state had kept shut. He published a state police report that set down what the farms looked like from the inside. The pages spoke of thin food, long days, violence, and graft. The findings had been gathered before he took office. He chose to release them on his first winter week. The choice said more than a speech could. Tom Merton arrived soon after with a narrow goal that felt large. Make the farms lawful. Take speed out of punishment. Put record keeping above rumor. He told men that the strap would not decide the day. He walked the barracks and the fields and the infirmary. He wrote notes on a stiff card and spoke to anyone who would answer in a steady tone. The press learned his map in a hurry. He sent them to places where the stories clustered. A hallway outside the hospital at Tucker. A laundry. A stretch of dirt along the levee at Cummins. The levee drew them the strongest. Old rumors lived there. People said men had gone missing and never come home. On a January morning in 1968, shovels went in and gray earth rose in cold clods. Bones lay in that earth. The cameras caught the moment when the first shape came clear. A rib, then more. Crews adjusted focus and said nothing. Officers set a line for space and told workers to keep back. Merton kept his voice low as he asked for bags and tags. He did not name the dead. He said only that they would be counted and kept, and that the ground would be searched again. The farm felt different with the press on site. Trustees watched the reporters from the edges. Free officers kept their faces still. Workers in the rows looked up and then went back to their pace. The sound of the wind over the river carried between groups who would not speak to one another. The levee stood as a wall between an old way and a new pressure that did not leave when the trucks drove out. In the weeks that followed, Merton wrote and spoke more than any Arkansas prison official had in years. He described what he had seen. He kept dates and times straight. He wrote down names when he could prove them, and left blanks when he could not. He sent notes to his superiors and told the press what he had told the office. The work was method and witness at once. The device with the crank did not lead the headlines that winter. The graves did. But the quiet tools of control sat close to the edge of each story. Men told reporters about shocks that did not leave marks and straps that had ruled the hall until they were taken away. The public learned a vocabulary that had been private to the farms. It learned that order could hide many things. By the next year, Merton had set his account to paper in full. The book made a single argument. Abuse did not happen by accident on a few hard days. It was built into the system and survived because it served people who managed the place. The words were plain and angry. The scenes were simple and exact. Readers far from Arkansas saw the rows and the barracks and the hospital room as if they were there. There was a cost to the work. Merton's stance that sunlight was part of his job put him at odds with people above him. He kept pushing. They pushed back. His tenure on the farms was short. The cameras kept the story alive after he left. The ground he had pointed at remained part of the record and could not be put back in the dark. The line from our first chapter to this one runs through a small room and a quiet device. It reaches the levee where bones came up in the winter light. The story had moved from whispers to film and to print. What came next would move it to a courtroom. The farm could bend when people watched. The question hanging over the fields now was simple. What could force change to stay when the cameras went away? Chapter 5, Unconstitutional. December 9, 1968. St. Louis. The Eighth Circuit released an opinion that cut to the core of discipline on Arkansas's prison farms. The court said the strap could not survive the Constitution. It did not carve out exceptions. It ended the practice. The case was Jackson versus Bishop. Prisoners had challenged whipping as discipline. The district court had tried limits, rules, and safeguards. The appeals court said safeguards could not fix what was wrong. Whipping was punishment that failed the Eighth Amendment. That single ruling pulled a keystone from the old order. On the ground, the change was immediate in name and slower in habit. The strap moved out of offices and storerooms. Lines in the rules shifted. Men still felt power in the silent places between policy and practice. The question of what would replace the strap reached every barracks and field. A year later, another case reached a broader target. Holt versus Sarver began with inmates from the Cummins farm asking for relief. They pointed to isolation cells packed dirty and close. They pointed to thin medical care. They pointed to the fear of assault at night when lights went down and bunks sat in open rooms. In 1969, the district court agreed that parts of the system crossed the constitutional line. Overcrowded isolation was not just unpleasant. It was punishment that offended modern standards and dignity. The court set out relief and told the state to report back with concrete steps. It was the first time in Arkansas that a court moved past one punishment and into the fabric of daily confinement. The next winter, the court went further. On February 18, 1970, the judge held that the total conditions in Arkansas's penitentiary system made confinement itself a cruel and unusual punishment. He rejected the claim that farm labor without pay violated the 13th Amendment. He sustained the claim that the 8th and 14th Amendments were violated by the way the system operated day to day. The opinion spoke in plain terms. Open barracks let fear do the work of a lock. Trusty guards with rifles carried state power without state training. Protection from other inmates failed as a basic duty. Medical care and sanitation lagged. The whole arrangement fell below the line the Constitution sets for punishment in a civil society. The court did not stop with declarations. It ordered the state to eliminate the unconstitutional conditions and to file a plan on a timetable. It said the duty to fix the system did not depend on new laws or new money. If Arkansas chose to run prisons, those prisons had to run within the Constitution. By the summer of 1970, changes began to show on paper and on payrolls. The state moved to replace convict trustees with free world personnel. The practice of using inmates as armed guards was marked for an end. The shift took time, training, and dollars. It also took the constant pressure of a federal judge asking for reports and proof. The appeal came the next spring. On May 5, 1971, the Eighth Circuit affirmed the district court. The panel kept Jackson versus Bishop in view and agreed that Arkansas's system-wide conditions fell short of constitutional minimums. The affirmation meant the orders below were not a passing storm. They were the weather for the years ahead. What changed on paper is easy to list. The strap was banned. The trusty guard system faced extinction. Isolation had limits and had to meet basic standards of sanitation and safety. Oversight moved from informal habits to written plans that could be checked. The words Eighth Amendment became part of the daily language of Arkansas corrections. What changed in practice took longer and did not move in a straight line. Some officers adjusted. Some trustees lost rifles and found jobs in kitchens and laundries. Budgets shifted to hire and train staff. New units rose with cells and corridors built for control without open barracks. The small medical rooms grew a little larger and a little cleaner. In the fields and barracks, men felt both the promise and the gaps. A posted rule is a start. A habit is a force. Habits learned over decades do not vanish in a term of court. The ban on whipping held. The culture of speed and silence still pressed on every decision. A man who spoke up still risked trouble in the hours when the lights were low. One part of the opinion in 1970 mattered beyond Arkansas. The court said it would look at the totality of conditions, not one act at a time. That approach gave inmates a way to show how small harms added up to a daily injury. It told officials that changing a single policy would not cure a system if the rest stayed the same. The rulings also had limits. The court did not end farm labor. It said labor without pay could be part of punishment for crime. It did not write a modern prison manual for the state. It wrote a floor, not a ceiling. The day-to-day work of building a constitutional system fell to the people who ran the farms. The story from earlier chapters runs under these pages in a low line. The small room. The device with a crank. Quiet methods that did not leave obvious marks. Jackson closed one door. Holt closed the hallway. A culture built to value speed and obedience still had corners where pain could hide if no one looked closely. There is a moment worth holding. It is the image of a judge telling the state to let men fall asleep without fear of a blade in the night. That simple standard says as much about punishment and dignity as any statute. It is specific enough to measure and human enough to remember. After the affirmance, Arkansas turned more of its attention to staffing, training, and written procedures. The state added free world officers. It narrowed the use of open barracks. It began to track incidents with forms that someone outside could read. The path was uneven and contested. It went forward more than it slid back. Did these rulings end the telephone? They made it far riskier. They put words on the books that matched what reformers had demanded for years. They told investigators and nurses what to do when they saw signs that did not fit the chart. They did not erase every hidden practice on the day they were filed. The legal victories also gave language to men who wrote letters home and to lawyers. A man could say the Eighth Amendment in a way that would be heard. He could say totality of conditions and be understood. He could say that a ban on the strap did not stop a shock in a small room if the system still rewarded quiet speed. By the close of this chapter, the Arkansas prison system had a new map. Courts watched it. Reporters understood its names and dates. Officials could no longer say the old ways were local custom. The question that remains is the one that lives in every place like Tucker after a public reckoning. Did the changes reach the corners where men were alone with officers, devices, and doubt? Chapter 6, After the Rulings. The first changes showed up on paper. Policy sheets landed on desks. Captains posted new orders on cork boards in the halls. A sergeant read the rules to a room of officers and trustees who were on their way out of authority. The tone was firm and even. The message was simple. The old practices were no longer allowed. The state would build a different way to run a day. Men signed forms that listed their duties in clear lines. Use of force had levels now. Reports had to be written after any incident. A supervisor had to see the report and initial it before the end of the shift. A nurse had to examine anyone who said he had been hurt. A camera came out more often. A clipboard gained weight as it moved from hand to hand. The device with the crank did not vanish in a headline. It faded. Inmates still spoke of it into the early 1970s. They did so with less fear and more distance as the years turned. A nurse who once held a towel on a contact point now held a checklist. A new officer with a badge that said trainee stood where a trustee with a rifle had stood. The silence around the old room thinned, then broke. The end of armed trustees mattered. For years, men in stripes had carried rifles and keys. They had set the pace in the rows and in the barracks. After the rulings, that power was marked for removal. The state began to hire more free-world officers. It trained them to count, to search, to report, and to move a group from one place to another without a weapon in an inmate's hands. The change did not happen in a week. It did happen. Training became a word people used every day. Officers ran through short courses on use of force, first aid, and fire response. They learned to write an incident report in plain terms and to avoid the kind of slang that had hidden the truth before. They learned to call medical staff when a man fell to the floor, not to offer a cup of water and send him to his bunk. They learned that a missing sentence on a form could carry a cost. The medical rooms grew a little larger. They took in new cabinets and a few more supplies. A schedule brought a doctor more often and a nurse daily. Records shifted from casual notes to charts that someone outside the fence could read. The chart listed a blood pressure, a pulse, and a time. It listed who saw the patient and what was done. The patient signed his name. The nurse signed hers. Paper made a promise to the future. Tucker itself kept its shape as a farm. Rose still ran to the tree line. Hogs still rooted near the pens. The unit fed itself and sent cash crops out on trucks. But the map around Tucker changed. A separate high-custody unit rose nearby in the early 1980s. People called it the Maximum Security Unit when it opened. It took men who needed close control and tight movement. It took some of the pressure off the old farm to be all things at once. Those two places were not the same, even though they shared a name and a road sign. Tucker Unit remained a farm prison with long fields and work details. The other place was a tighter build with cells, runs, and heavier doors. Confusing the two helps no one. The difference matters because it shows the state had started to divide custody by need rather than force every problem through a single gate. Oversight took on a rhythm. Inspectors walked the halls with clipboards and checklists. They asked to see logs. They looked for missing signatures and missing times. They spoke to inmates in low voices and wrote down what they heard. They checked where the first aid kits were stored and whether the seals were broken. They asked an officer to walk them through the steps for an emergency count. The visit ended with a short meeting and a list of fixes. In the barracks, men felt the change in small ways. A rumor about a trip to the hospital no longer brought the same dread. A request for sick call stood a better chance of getting a response before dark. A letter home about a beating had a chance to be met with a call from someone outside who knew the names and the dates. These were not miracles. They were margins. Margins can save lives. Old habits do not leave on their own. A supervisor who had worked in the old days still liked the quiet that comes when people fear you more than they trust you. A nurse who had learned to keep things in-house still chose a bandage over a report. A new officer sometimes copied a tone that made men shrink. The difference now was that a rule existed to pull those choices back. If a captain enforced the rule, the system could correct itself before harm became culture again. The farm adjusted to accountability. When a fight broke out in a row, the officer called for help on a radio instead of waving a trustee over. When a man collapsed in the heat, a cart came for him and a nurse met him at the door. When a count did not match, the unit went on a controlled hold while officers checked names and sheets. The steps took longer than the old ways. They also left a record. Records are hard to argue with. Supervision improved when the state hired people whose job was to supervise. That is a simple sentence, but but it matters. The old system had let inmates manage inmates because the budget was thin. The new map tried to replace that with staff whose duty could be measured and whose mistakes could be punished. Training and pay did not make saints. They did make a floor. A floor is something you can stand on. The device that had defined the worst of Tucker's reputation turned into a photograph in a file and a line in a training talk about ethics. Instructors used it as a warning about how easy it is to turn a tool into a weapon when no one is watching. They used it to teach recruits that names matter more than slang. The point was not to shame a room. The point was to say, this happened here, and your job is to make sure it does not happen again. People still asked about the name when they toured the place or read about it in a book. They asked whether it had really been used. They asked how long it had lasted. They asked whether anyone had paid a price for it. Staff learned to answer in plain terms. Yes, men were hurt like that. Yes, the practice survived into the 1970s. Yes, the courts and the public made a difference. The rest is a longer story about records and time. The unit kept the farm because work still shaped a day and a year. But the theory of work shifted. On paper, labor now fit under safety and dignity rather than fear and speed. A man who learned to repair a fence could get a certificate that proved he had learned it. A man who kept a clean record in a job could earn a transfer to a better detail. These are small things. They are also the bones of a life after a sentence. Not everything that changed could be seen by a visitor on a short walk. Some of it lived in how a captain handled a complaint. Some lived in how a nurse wrote a number. Some lived in how an officer spoke to a line at dawn. The difference between a farm that scares people into silence and a farm that runs on rules is the sum of those small choices. The rulings forced those choices into the open. The years after the court orders looked uneven. Budgets rose and fell. Staff came and left for better pay elsewhere. A bad winter or a hot summer stressed the place and showed where the seams were weak. Yet the device did not come back out of the cabinet. The towel did not fold over the leads. The small room lost its power when light and paper took up space there. The lesson that sat under all of this was not abstract. A system can be built to make harm easy, and then call it normal. It can also be rebuilt to make harm hard, and then call that normal instead. The difference lies in who holds the keys, who reads the reports, and who asks questions when a number does not make sense. Those questions are the guardrails. Without them, routine will find its old path. By the end of this chapter, Tucker stood as a place with a long memory and a stricter rule book. The past did not vanish. It turned into training slides, policies, and quiet talks between officers at shift change. Men still woke before daylight. They still lined up. They still went to work. But the room with the crank had become a caution rather than a tool. That is not a victory to boast about. It is a standard to keep. The step that remains is the hardest one to hold. What protects people when routine starts to drift? What stops a quiet room from gaining power again when a captain is tired and a budget is thin? What keeps the policy on the wall from turning into a faded sheet that no one reads? Those are the questions that point to the final chapter, where memory and oversight meet and decide how much of this history will be allowed to repeat. Chapter 7, What We Choose to Remember. The room was small, quiet, and bright. A case held a wooden box with a hand crank, worn smooth where fingers turned the handle. A card named the object and the place. A visitor asked if it was real. The docent said yes. The answer came without drama. Truth did not need volume here. People still ask about the name. They ask when it started and when it ended. They ask who was responsible. They ask if anyone faced charges. The questions carry weight because a simple box makes the story plain. A device sat on a table. People used it on other people. A system let it stand. Memory lives in more than a case. It lives in letters saved by families and in court files that list dates and voices. It lives in training rooms where recruits hear a short, steady talk about harm and duty. It lives in the way an officer pauses before a choice and thinks about paper, policy, and eyes from outside. If that pause holds, history is doing its work. The story that began in a small room at Tucker does not end at that gate. Other farm systems face their own reckonings. Fields, trustees, long days, and thin staff formed the same shape across parts of the South. Lawsuits reach courtrooms. Judges wrote about dignity and safety in plain terms. The strap lost ground. Open barracks gave way to tighter builds. These shifts varied by place and year, yet the direction showed. What people choose to remember often depends on how a story is told. When the focus sits on a single device, the box takes on a life larger than its size. When the focus widens to a structure, the device turns into a symptom. Both views matter. One offers a clear image. The other offers a map. The first draws attention. The second shows where to work. Present-day talk in Arkansas prisons still circles labor, safety, and control. Work details move men through their days and seasons. The state tracks output and budgets. Staff face heat, cold, and stress, then go home to families. Inside this pressure, shortcuts tempt people who value speed over rule. That is the point where oversight either steps in or steps aside. Protections exist because someone wrote them after hard lessons. Training tells officers to log force, call medical, and alert supervisors. Policies ask for two signatures where one once passed. Audits pull random reports and check times and names. Grievance lines exist, so a small voice reaches beyond a fence. Records and eyes give weight to rules. Without those, old habits creep back into corners. Men inside carry this memory in another way. They pass warnings bunk to bunk about rooms where trouble gathers. They skin rosters and learn which shifts run hot. They hold names of officers who treat them square and names of officers who do not. When they meet a lawyer or a pastor, they say the names out loud. Names hold systems to account better than gossip or fear. Honest memory does not flatten people. Some officers from the old days stayed because they wanted a better order and took pride when work moved from fear to rule. Some inmates later chose to speak, even though they paid a price for it years earlier. The story is not one note. It is a set of choices under pressure. Respect grows when a reader sees those choices in full. Public memory also reaches children who tour a site or read a plaque. They carry the image of a crank and wires into civics class. They learn why courts exist beyond guilt and innocence. Courts also set floors for how a state treats the people it holds. A floor is not a ceiling. It is the ground on which a better day stands. There is a practical use to this history. It gives officers, nurses, and wardens a shared language. When someone says, "We are not going back to that," a room understands without more words. When someone says, "Write it down now," a room moves. When someone on a camera call asks, "Where is the log?" the answer arrives fast. Memory sets a pace for accountability. The Tucker story also speaks to people outside prisons. It shows how ordinary tools become instruments of pain when no one looks. It shows how budgets and habits shape power. It shows how a word like telephone can turn a weapon into a joke for the people who use it. It shows why a judge's plain sentence about sleep without fear matters as much as a headline. What works as protection today is not mysterious. Hire and train enough staff to avoid leaning on inmates for control. Keep use of force rules tight and clear. Put medical in the loop at once when someone is hurt. Visit units without warning and speak to people in private. Back officers who follow policy. Remove officers who do not. Post the rules where everyone can see them. Read the logs. Ask about blank lines and missing times. The opposite is simple too. Thin staff. Thin logs. A pride in quiet over proof. A belief that speed saves time. A culture like that turns tools into threats and offices into scenes. It also sends a message down the ranks that no one is watching. That message is the root of harm in places like Tucker. The display case at the start of this chapter sat near a wall of names and dates. Men who served and men who suffered. Officials who signed orders. Judges who signed opinions. Journalists who stood in fields and halls with notebooks in winter light. None of them alone fixed the problem. Together, they changed the odds. The box with the crank returns as a warning and as a test. When a state drifts toward speed and silence, the box holds up a mirror. When a state builds habit and record, the box sits behind glass where it belongs. The past does not move unless people move it. That is the charge. The line through these seven chapters is straight. A room. A farm. A device. People who used it. People who spoke. Cameras. Courts. Orders. Training. Paper. The present sits on all of it. The question that ends the series is short and firm. Will we keep the names, keep the records, and keep watch when the pressure of routine pushes in? If the answer is yes, the box stays in glass. If the answer slips, the room fills again.